We like to begin our classes by making the sound of Om together. It takes us down into our spiritual center. So we're going to invite the music from the sanctuary into our class this morning. Morning, sir. Let's prepare for the Om by taking 3 deep and conscious breaths. And with the deep in breath, lots of sounds today.
How delightful to hear the enthusiastic children.
Our classroom experience today. Satchidananda, the Bhagavad Gita, a path for personal spiritual transformation. Over the past several months, we've been studying the Bhagavad Gita. We've been studying chapter 2, which is called the Yoga of Wisdom. The Yoga of Wisdom. And we learned many things about wisdom. The last few sessions, we've begun chapter 3, which is called Karma Yoga. Karma meaning action. Karma means action. Ancient Sanskrit word, the yoga of action. What we're going to study today, to me, for the Western consciousness, is rather revolutionary. It's a call to our deepest spiritual longing. It is an opportunity for us to engage in our passion and see if that is a route we wish to take. Passion. It's not going to be complex. It's going to be very simple. Very simple. So here we go. Let's jump into it. The Bhagavad Gita. And Bhagavad Gita merely means the song of truth. The song of truth, I believe. Chapter 3. We're at sloka, or verse 7 now. And these slokas, or verses, are condensed, very condensed. You could spend years on one sloka. Let's take a look at number 7. Sloka number 7. In order to excel, mentally control the senses, let go all attachments, and engage the body in karma yoga, selfless service. So simple. We're given 3 things here if we want to excel. The first is mentally control the senses. And in Satchidananda's commentary, that's what he's going to focus on. The Let's explore. What does that mean, to mentally control the senses? Control the senses. Is there anyone here that doesn't control their senses? Are our senses out of control? What is this sloka telling us? What are our senses, first of all? We see, we hear, we taste, we smell, we feel, and we experience. Those are our senses. Do we control those senses, or are we rather victims of our senses? To excel, we should mentally control the senses, that is, use our mind. The second one, which we'll get into in actually other shlokas, is to let go of attachments. Let go of attachments. What does that mean? What are attachments? What are attachments?
Desires.
Desires, wants, expectations.
Stuff.
Yeah, stuff, things.
Stuff.
Yeah.
Attachments. We're attached to our things, aren't we?
For people too.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe attached to our people in our life. There's a difference between being attached and simply having. We can have people in our lives, can have things in our lives, and we don't need to be attached to them. Meaning we allow those things to come and go, as nature or the universe brings them to us, takes them away. Let go all attachments. And thirdly, engage the body in karma yoga, selfless service. What does it mean to devote our bodies to selfless service? We'll look at that in a sloka after this one. So bang, right up front, we're giving these three things. Mentally control the senses. Let's look at that and see if we are drawn to this verse. Satchidananda says, that means the mind is totally in control, but one just allows the body to do certain acts for the sake of the actions themselves. Mind is totally in control, but one just allows the body to do certain acts for the sake of the actions themselves. It's a subtle difference. Have you experienced setting out to do something and then doing it? Have you experienced a situation arising and you just do what comes to you? The action flows out of you. It's not that you've thought about it or want to do it or don't want to do it. It just flows out of you. And you do the act for the sake of the action itself. I think mothers might appreciate this. I'm guessing there are times in motherhood you don't think about this, or should I or shouldn't I? You just do an action for the sake of the action itself, without even expecting a particular result. Rather, you're called to do it, and you do it. Sometimes the action is gratifying, the result, and sometimes it's disappointing. But you are content because you were called to do the action that flowed out of you, did that action. One just allows the body to do certain acts for the sake of the actions themselves. And he points out that here a kind of discipline is necessary. Discipline. Now he's going to talk about the discipline. For example, you might be preparing food to be offered at the altar. I had used Satchitananda's example here, although it may not resonate so much with all of us. I'm going to use it anyway. For example, do we have an altar here at our Unity Church? Do we?
The podium, you mean?
Altar.
Well,
I know we have a podium, that's where everyone stands, it's the raised area. Do we have an altar, which is a place for offerings? We don't, do we? It's not part of our religious practice. But we do know there are other practices where there are altars. For example, in the Roman Catholic tradition, there's an altar, isn't there? And it's where what they call the Eucharist is performed, where the bread and the wine is given as a gift, and people then consume that gift. As you'll see in the Hindu tradition, they also use altars in the temples, and they also use food. The foods are dedicated to God, and afterwards they are consumed, just as in the Roman Catholic tradition or in other conservative traditions. So we'll imagine now that we're in one of those traditions where there is an altar, and we've been called to prepare the food to be offered at the altar. So in the Roman Catholic tradition, the priests prepare the food, the wafers or the wine. And they prepare it, do they? They buy it. In other traditions, people prepare the food, which is placed on the altar. This food would be called prasad in Sanskrit, prasad. Prasad, the food that's placed on the altar. You make quite delicious dishes. From the beginning, your feeling is that you are doing something for God. You're doing something for God. You're making the food. The food is for God. You're going to put the food on the altar. Have any of us experienced in our lifetime doing something just for God? Doing something just for God. It could be that if some of us have participated in working on our sacred 5 acres, our grounds here with earth care, and preparing the gardens, perhaps we looked upon our efforts as a gift to the universe or God. Perhaps.
I think if you do anything, this is just me talking, I think if you do anything sort of out of love in service, that in and of itself is for God.
Yeah.
It doesn't have to be any particular. It doesn't have to be labeled that as such. You know,
yes.
Anything in service.
So anything could be a gift for God.
Yeah.
And the question for us is, in our consciousness at the time we prepare for it and do it, is our mind in a consciousness that this is a gift to God. This is a gift for, we may look at it later on and see what it was, but is our consciousness beforehand and in the act. This is a gift for God. You know, when the artisans built the great Gothic cathedrals in the Middle Ages, the artisans who built it looked at their work as a gift for God, we're told. A gift for God. That's why up in the higher reaches of the cathedrals and places that are behind that no one can see unless you get a helicopter or something. The images that are carved there are done just as meticulously and beautifully and with this great passion as the ones for all to see. Because all the images are a gift for God, not to satisfy one's artistic ambition, or to have one's name put on there, I did this. No, it's a gift for God. We are told that when the ancient Egyptians 2,000 years ago built the pyramids, they had the same consciousness. Every stone and block that was carved, exact dimensions. Gift for God. No one can see the inside of the pyramids where these stones were carved so perfectly. We were down in Peru years ago and saw how the ancient Inca people carved stones and made walls and temples and everything. These stones weren't regular, they were irregular, but everything fit together so perfectly. These were not meant in a practical sense, I don't think. They were meant as a gift for God, and the men who made these and women, I'm guessing, had that consciousness. Making gifts for God is part of our humanity, even though we may not practice it so much in our current Western culture. Here's a particular example that Satchitananda is talking about. They're preparing food to be offered at the altar. They call it prasad. And you might make quite delicious dishes. From the beginning, your feeling is that you're doing something for God. It should be very fine and tasty, making an excellent dish for God. According to the Hindu way of thinking, you shouldn't even smell or taste it. You've already tasted it by your senses. Through your eyes, nose, or tongue, it's already eaten. This is a gift for God, not to be eaten by you, even by tasting it through your eyes, nose, or tongue, and your thoughts. That's the goal of the offering. It's already eaten, it becomes unfit to be offered because you've tasted it in your eyes, a nose, or tongue. It's a way of controlling our senses. You see where he's going here? Controlling our senses. A gift to the altar such as this is an exercise in controlling the senses. What opportunities do we have in our modern life to control the senses? Here at church or other places? Not too many, I'm thinking. Not too many. And this ancient teaching says, in order to excel, one of the opportunities for us is to control our senses. Here is a particular exercise where one can control the senses. Another way we can control our senses, which is open to us, is through fasting. Fasting. That's something that we can do either in a religious setting. One could go down to Yogaville, for example, with the commitment to have a fast in a spiritual setting and have that experience of the determination of the mind to control the senses. Notice that the senses might have hunger-like experiences. The tummy feels a little raw. The tongue might want to salivate. The body might notice it's time. I normally eat a meal. And yet through a commitment or a passion to experience controlling the senses, one experiences those things and fasts. So that's an exercise available to us and maybe others. That's what I thought of. Satchidananda goes on. He says, complete control of the senses is necessary if we choose to excel and achieve spiritual transformation. Of course, in preparing something for another, sometimes you taste it, but not for the sake of your own tongue. You want your guest to have a delicious dish. The action is not for your own sake. Again, exercise in controlling the senses. You taste the food because you want to be sure your guest has a delicious dish. But you taste it for them, to serve them, not to satisfy your own craving for tastes. It's an exercise in controlling the senses. As I mentioned when we started the class, these may be concepts that are rather strange to us, or foreign to us, or unattractive, or seem like they're good for some other sorts of people, but not us. You know, good for people like that, but not for me. Those are all considerations that might come to mind.
I'm having a hard time with it. I mean, I realize that it's a different culture and how he's trying to come at it from his own culture and express his teaching, and I'm trying to make sense of it for me and
yes,
from our culture. And I think the only thing I'm coming up with at this point is that it's like, it's not so much that all this super control of our own senses so that you're literally not tasting it and all this stuff. For me, I think it's more that it's the idea of attachment. It's like if I have something to do, like what he's talking about, it's detaching from my senses in a sense. It's like I'm not so attached to the result that my ego takes over and I've got to eat everything or do everything for my own gratification. It's detaching from all of that.
Having the senses without being attached to them.
Yeah.
Yes.
And that would allow me to do it without my ego getting involved. And that's
yes,
where I am.
When I heard you say super control, I went, well, that's not the teaching here, to have super control of the senses. Super control is in our ego's heart.
Right,
charge.
It's our ego.
This is control in the sense of letting our egos go and releasing.
Right. And that's the detachment that I'm talking
release
about.
Release, like a detachment.
Right.
So a release, not a super control, but a release of our attachment.
Right.
The senses. I think you got it.
Okay. But it's the way he talks about it, it's hard for me.
It's sometimes hard for me as well. And I'm so intrigued by his teaching. I want to read it more and more and become immersed in his consciousness. I'm attracted to it. So I'm here with you to learn. I'm not here to tell you all this. I copied these words from his book. So I'm learning it along with you. If you do act in this way. He's talking about not being attached to the cooking. You do act in this way, you are cooking, and yet you are not cooking. Because you aren't cooking for your own personal enjoyment. He's trying to make a point here. You're cooking, you're not cooking because you aren't cooking for your own personal enjoyment. This is a case where even though you act, you personally are not acting. The cooking is coming out of you, just as when you were a mother, you did something for your child that came naturally for you, wasn't willful. Even though you act, you're not personally acting. It's the mother instinct in you that brought up that action. Can you let a deeper consciousness become familiar with what is yours to do and just let that happen so that you personally are not acting, rather you are performing what is yours to do? It's like the saying I gave you last week. Famous man was asked, see if we can call this, how do you act? And he said, I never decide. I never decide. For me, the only decision is God's decision. I never decide. For me, the only decision is God's decision, which comes up in me naturally. I never decide. Decide is an interesting word. Decide. Decide has the same root as homicide and suicide, patricide and fratricide. Decide is killing of the alternative. Killing of the alternative.
Oh, wow. I've never thought of that.
Decide.
Wow.
Yeah. Killed something.
Wow.
You kill the alternative when you decide. It's an act of will.
Wow.
If you don't decide and let the only decision be God's decision, God is in charge. Your ego self isn't killing off any alternatives. Let go of that. Become detached from killing off alternatives. When do we kill off alternatives? When we want to be right. We want to be right.
Or when we're frightened. You know, that's when you kill off alternatives, because you limit.
Yes, we're afraid. We're fearful. Right, we make a decision, we're fearful. So we want to be right, so we kill off an alternative. We decide something. We want to be right, make someone else wrong, kill an alternative. Rather than let the only decision be God's decision, and not you personally who be acting, that's the consciousness. Let all acts flow from you as expressions of your divine self, where he's heading. So you act, but the act comes from your deeper spiritual essence. It's a different consciousness, isn't it? We're taught all our lives to use our ego mind to figure this out and do this and get the grades in school. And if you get A, you're rewarded. If you get F, you're punished. We're not taught that whatever comes from you naturally is a gift to appreciate. And whether the teacher gives an A or an F for it, we honor it as what came from you naturally. You know, there are schools now that have done away with A's and F's and grades and labels and judgments that children often internalize and learn how to blame themselves. And then later on in life, externalize that by blaming others. having a habit of blaming others. Do we know anyone in our political life that has a habit of blaming others? And where does that come from? At some point one learned to blame oneself because one learned from the tree of knowledge right and wrong. And was told it was right, it was wrong, and blamed oneself. Blaming others sources always blaming ourselves and goes deeper to fears, as you point out, and angers that are encapsulated deep within at an early age and layer of behavior then results in a human personality. These teachings are designed to go way back into the origin of our human behaviors and consciousness and root out some of the decisions we made. You're bad, you got an F. You're good, you got an A, same thing. And blamed or praised ourselves, which are equally dangerous. What we're learning here is that when the action comes naturally from oneself, there's no praise. Got it? No praise. You have to let go of the praise as well as the blame. It's rather what's natural to you. A case where even though you act, you personally are not acting. It's what is yours to do that comes forth. It's a way of life and a discipline to look at ourselves and others through this new lens, and we have to be vigilant, as Satchidananda points out, if we want to begin to change the way we experience life. The promise is that if we do so, we will excel, as he said, excel. And experience something which we've heard is called spiritual transformation, bit by bit. You act, you personally are not acting. It's called inaction in action. We studied this in the Tao Te Ching. Inaction in action. Inaction in the sense that I'm not doing it. Action in the sense it comes from me naturally. This is tough for us. This is very simple, by the way, for trees. Trees have no problem. Grass have no problem with this. They just do what they're to do. Dogs, horses, animals, they do what is there to do. Rather, it's we humans. We humans who, from a young age, had our consciousness altered in such a way that we lost touch with what it's like to be a tree. Or the family dog, how to behave in that manner. We got layered up through fears of not being loved. This is wrong. I won't love you if you're doing that. We were afraid. We got angry when we felt we wouldn't be loved. It's all that built up. This is a call to an original way of being. Where you personally are not acting, it's called inaction in action. This is karma yoga that he's teaching here. Selfless action. All right, it's a lot to swallow, isn't it? Are we up for it? We've got about 5 more minutes. We'd like to close at 11. I'll give you a bit of a lesson here in some Sanskrit words, and we'll start with this again next week. languages have a way of giving us consciousness. The words that we use, we say this in unity, shape our consciousness. If we don't have a word for something, it doesn't exist in our consciousness. If we see a word for something that's not in our language, it can evoke a new consciousness. And in ancient times in India, several thousand years ago, when these religious concepts were like computer sciences today, the masters, the people of great intellects were studying them and crafting these religious concepts, they used the language of Sanskrit. And so Sanskrit has some marvelous words that we can use. Well, karma, for example, is a word we do use, isn't it? Right? Here's another one. In Sanskrit, a sacrificial ritual is called a yajnam, a sacrificial ritual. We talked about a ritual of offering food on the altar, not something that we do. Perhaps it's something we've seen in the movies and laughed at or made fun of. Those are not as evolved type people as we are. They're ancient people who didn't really... They were somehow they're mentally impaired. Didn't have the great intellects that we have. And in the movies, they're portrayed that way. In the movies, we can see movies where there are altars. Anyway, in Sanskrit, a sacrificial ritual is called a yajnam. But that's only the outward expression. Anything you do for the benefit of others is a true yajnam. Anything you do for the benefit of others rather than yourself. For the benefit of others. Like preparing food for a guest. That's a yajnam. If some benefit does just happen to come to you, all right, let it come. Don't be repulsed by it. If you eat the food and it's tasty, great. That's fine. Don't be distracted by your consciousness that you prepared this food to serve your guest, if that's what you truly did. But maybe you didn't. Maybe you prepared this food to serve your guest, but you also had in mind how much you were going to enjoy it. This is my favorite dish. I'm really looking forward to it. I hope my friend likes it too. What was your consciousness when you prepared the dish? Was it totally? Serve your friend. Totally. And if some benefit does come to you, just let it come. Don't be repulsed by it. But don't do it for the sake of what will come to you. Then it's a yajna. So if you prepare dinner for the guest and you're really happy that you're going to be eating this, it's your favorite food, it's not a yajna. If you're preparing it solely for the appreciation of the guest, that's the only thing in your mind, that's your consciousness, then in Sanskrit, they have a word for it. We don't have a word for it in our language, do we? No. But in Sanskrit, they do. It's called a yajnam, something you do totally, selflessly, without thought for your own experience, just for your guest. Yes, you taste it to make sure it has the taste you want your guest to enjoy, but not for your own pleasure. It's a consciousness, isn't it? And the consciousness is represented by this word in Sanskrit, yajna. When we learn a new word like this, we are able to begin looking at a new consciousness that's available to us. Yajnam. And we'll look some more at this next week. And we'll go over it again because it's all rather new and strange, isn't
it?
Yeah,
just introduce this thing.
New and strange.
I didn't feel like it's so strange. I just feel like the approach is different. You know what I mean? it's just that, again, I struggle with sort of the way they're getting to it.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I understand the conclusion better than I do the process of getting there, I guess. You know, it's just hard for me to go that way. It's
good.
What I'm hearing is that, you know, the senses and stuff, is that senses are really helpful and we use them and they're, you know, get us through the world, but to not, to come, get to a place where they don't have to rule you.
Yeah.
That you can.
I agree.
Yeah.
Right.
You can have the senses, but they don't have you.
Right.
Yeah.
It's like the tail wagging the dog, mm-hmm. as opposed to the dog
yeah.
wagging the tail.
We're going to close now by making the sound of Om together, because it's just after 11. Are we up for that?
Mm-hmm.
Let's take 3 deep breaths. And a deep in breath. Peace.
Thank you, Steve.
Thank you.
Have a great service.